America, I think we're all kind of recovering from the election. Some of people are in shock. Others are overjoyed at the Donald being elected our new president. You know, it's interesting. You know, I was shocked. I didn't vote for the guy. I mean, he had a lot of cool things to say. And but, you know, I was worried that he wasn't a politician. And here he is being voted in as the next president. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I've had a lot of friends. Deborah, my closest girlfriend, she wore black for like 3 days, you know, and people are like freaking out. But, hey, when it comes down to it, he's going to have to surround himself with politicians because he doesn't know anything about government, you know. So all I can say is, you know, get over your mourning. I was in shock too. I didn't vote for the guy. And, you know, get back into your groove and take care of yourself, mind, body, and spirit. Take care of yourself and we'll write it. We'll write it out. You know, it's funny. I just read the other day that he's kind of seeing reality now. And, you know, you got to support. He's our president. You got to support him. So I'm hoping he does the best he can. But he took a look at the Obamacare infrastructure, and he's already saying, you know, we're not going to do much on this here. We're, you know, he was going to gut it originally, but now he's saying, well, I think looking at it the way it is, we're going to modify it. We're going to modify it. So I think he's going to start looking at some of these campaign promises he made, and he's kind of going to go, okay, well, I'm not sure we can do that. But anyhow, listen, congratulations to the Donald. We hope he does well, and he is our next president. You, those of you who are listening from around the world, who are always interested in American stuff, you're probably shocked too. But hey, that's what makes America great. You know, a guy who's a businessman can be voted into office. You don't have to be a politician. And I think that was one of the biggest problems in this election, is that people were just sick of these politicians. The Clinton, Hillary Clinton, came from, you know, she was with Bill, who was a former president. And people are thinking, you know, we don't need this anymore. I'm not doing well. I'm out here on my farm. I'm losing my farm, or I don't have a job or something like that. And they felt that, you know, the Donald was going to see their point of view a little better. So that's why they voted him in. So anyhow, hang in there, ride it out. We're going to be okay. I think this is going to work out. I got a really cool new image that I posted on Stonehenge. This is on the Facebook page. And each week, check out Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to the group page. There's a 360-degree image of somebody who is standing in the middle of Stonehenge. And as he's moving the camera, and this is a special camera. This isn't a regular iPhone or something like that. You can actually pan or move the viewing of this site upward. So you're looking at these giant monoliths. And whoever took this photograph, this is amazing. He's standing, or she is standing, right next to the largest monoliths. This thing must weigh, I'm going to say, 5 to 10 tons. It's huge. It's huge. And as you move your mouse on your laptop or your computer, or even on your phone, on your smartphone, you can see the sheer size of these monoliths. They're monstrous. And so you pan around, you go up, you go down, you move around. This technology, I got to figure out a way to get it. And when I go to Mexico, take some images of these megaliths and these ruins that we're going to be touring at. So check that out on Facebook, the Stonehenge image. And you can't miss it. The first thing you see is this gigantic block of rock. The other thing I posted is the oldest trees in the world. And there's four of these trees, and the average age is 3,000 years old. The two cool ones are the Methuselah, which is 4,646 years old. And then there's the Pinus longaviae, which is 5,066 years old, you know, and we don't typically talk about trees, but these are very, very long-lived trees. And I'm here in Northern California. We have what they call the Avenue of the Giants, which is just north of me by, I think it's about 150, 200 miles. And these are the giant sequoia redwoods. And those trees, their average is about 1,000 years. Maybe there's a few that are 1,500. There's one, I think, that dates to Christ, which would be 2,500 years old. And we took a look at those recently. But these trees, you know, 5,000 years old. I mean, I'm just surprised that they're still alive. It's amazing. So check that out. Always check it out. It's always on Facebook. And you can take a look at these monstrous trees, man, and they're ancient, totally old. Somebody sent me another cool photo. It's another 360-degree image. This one is of the Great Pyramid in Uxmal. And Uxmal is one of the places we're going to go check out next April. And this image is really nice. It's rarely done because they usually don't let you go up on these pyramids. But this is one of these pyramids that's been somewhat consolidated and constructed in a way that people can climb. It's a steep climb. The thing's about 150 feet in the air. And the person who took this image, he or she pans down to the ground. You see the stairwell. He goes up. He turns around. You see the entrance to the housing, which is it's a room at the top of the pyramid. He doesn't go in. But he pans out. You can see the nunnery, which is another big building, which is part of the central complex at Uxmal. And it's really, really cool. And go check that out, because it's very rare that you get to see something like that on a 360. And if you're really interested, come out and join me on the Path of the Sacred Maya tour, which is April 2nd through the 8th. You know, we're going to start out in Mérida, and then going to be a very unusual tour, because we're not just going to stay in one area. We're going to go see like five different sites. We're going to see Mayapan, Ekbalam, which is with those long head figurines that are part of the decoration of the pyramid. We're going to go see Chichen Itza, which is a monstrosity it's probably one of the largest Mayan ruins around other than Tikal. And it's considered a Mayan university. We're going to go to Cabal, and then we're going to go to Uxmal, which was just an amazing place. April 2nd through 8th, you can now see the entire itinerary. If you just go to earthancients.com, and you'll see each of the places we're going to have a photograph of each. And you can actually see the itinerary. You can see details about each of the locations. Hey, and come out and hang with me for a week. It's going to be a blast. We're going to have a lot of fun. I'm going to pull some people out from some of the shows to talk to us via Skype. We're going to talk to a number of experts. We're going to have Miguel Angel there, who's a Mayan shaman, and he's going to be doing some ceremonies at this site. And it's just going to be amazing. It's going to be renewing. It's going to trigger energetics within your body. The elders have told me, this has been for over 20 years, that a lot of these sites have been activated again. Remember, most of these pyramids are built over geomagnetic fields. Some actually are under rivers, and the combination of the energy pulsing up into the pyramids and out just bathes you in these energetics. And so it shifts you. You're actually being shifted. So come out and join me. Go see it. You can see the whole itinerary. You can see the photographs. Go to earthancients.com and check it out. It's going to be a fun time. I hope you'll join me. Hey, I want to send a thanks to Mark Foster, my webmaster. Mark's done a great job. Get on that website. Go to the website, earthancients.com, and sign up, because I have a newsletter that we're going to be producing each month. And the only way you're going to be able to get it is if you register for that information. there is articles that I'm writing. I'm writing a new piece right now about an unusual new stele that they found about 10 years ago in southern Yucatan. And you're going to be blown away by the carving. The only thing I can say is a spaceman. The dude's holding a ray gun. He's got a space suit on. He's got a helmet on. And it's not like, hey, you know, this is Ancient Aliens. This is something that's really, really cool. So anyhow, check out the website and sign up, because I'm going to be giving more free stuff away. Those of you who got the Valerie Uvaroff Pyramid book, I bet you enjoy that right now. If you didn't get it, get on that email. I'll be sending a second blast out, because people are sending me information wanting to be a part of that that email PDF, that book. It's the ebook called The Pyramid. And if you didn't get a copy, just go and sign up, and I'll be sending another blast out later. So check it out. Hey, also, call out to Curtis Hartog, the designer. Curtis does an amazing job. He does all of our graphics. He does the graphics on our Facebook page. He does the banners. He designed most of the website. He's just very, very, very talented. And Curtis, man, I couldn't do it without you. So thanks for doing that great work. Hey, we're talking about giants today, and we've had a few people on the program who have spoken about giants. We had Richard Dewhurst probably about a year and a half ago talking about giants around the world, and he did have giants featured in America, but most of his reporting was based on articles that had been found in the 1800s. He had a few photographs. And then there was Hugh Newman. Hugh wrote a book, and his book is, you know, articles and things like that. His book is pretty interesting. But, I mean, we're all into giants, right? I mean, for some reason, we have giants on the brain. Did you guys check out that movie recently? It's called Jack the Giant Slayer. Here's an excerpt from that.
Fee, fi, fo, fum. Ask not whence the thunder comes. For between heaven and earth is a perilous place, home to a fearsome giant race, who hunger to conquer the mortals below, waiting for the seeds of revenge to grow.
Now, if you guys saw that movie, and that, by the way, that was a very cool movie. Those giants were like, Jesus, they were ridiculous. That was total fantasy. They were like 100 feet high. One of the dudes had two heads. But what isn't a BS is the fact that apparently some of these giants actually were cannibals and would eat humans. And I think Dewhurst talked a little bit about that. But, you know, each one of these authors are just taking a perspective, which is from written articles, you know, and they have evidence also of some, you know, bones here and there. I think Dewhurst has photos of giants in the Carolinas, which are North and South Carolina, but also in California, in Nevada, in the Western United States. But really, who do we know has firsthand accounts with giants? And my guest today is Xavier Hayes, and we've had Xavier on before. He's written about the suppressed United States, Lewis and Clark's expedition. And he's always kind of into the curious, not conspiracies, but some of his stuff is conspiracy based, but he's always got interesting stuff. And I wanted to have him back because he has a new book out. The book's called Ancient Giants of the Americas, Suppressed Evidence and the Hidden History of a Lost Race. Hey, how you doing, Xavier? How you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah. Hey, what is this about suppressed evidence? Is it like everything that comes out of America is suppressed? Is that the deal?
It is nowadays for some reason. You know, we're going into the great unknown with Trump now, so, you know, maybe some things will start coming to the light. I think we're involved in a seismic shift in history right now. I mean, the Cubs won. That was insane.
Yeah.
Trump's in there. The Lost Dutchman mine has been found. So, I mean, we're moving towards something spectacular, I think, in a good way.
Well, did you vote for the Donald? Was he your man?
Of course, yeah. I mean, to me, any vote not for him is a vote for the New World Order. And you definitely can't vote for Hillary. That's just disgusting and evil and wicked. I like Jill Stein, some of the things she had to say, but, I mean, obviously she had no chance.
She's the Green Party now. Green Party.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, to me, Ron Paul will always be my president, so I guess it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Well, let's cross our fingers that the Donald will be good for us.
Oh, man, I hope, because basically it's like this. We're all on the ship, and, you know, if it goes down, we go down together. So it's kind of, we should want him to do good. And of course, you got to be aware of the snakes in the grass. And, you know, he's not a politician. He's a businessman. So, you know, the idea of him getting there and then everyone else trying to lurk their way in and weasel their way in, it's going to be tough. You know, it's, you know,
who knows
what's
going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully he doesn't get his brains blown out on TV like JFK, you know?
we don't want to see that.
Nah, we don't want
to see that. There is some of that talk, though. There is some of that
talk. It's all over. It's disgusting. Yeah. It's just horrible. Yeah. It's George Soros is funding it. The media continues to go with it because they've been totally discredited. WikiLeaks is, you know, been revealing and insightful some of the information it's shared. I mean, for the fact that, you know, the Clinton Foundation owns basically 75% of CNN through various shell companies. That's it's quite alarming. So,
So let's talk about this book. Now, you wrote the book, The Suppressed History of America, which was very interesting, and you actually chronicled Lewis and Clark, and they ran into giants, and there was a lot of really strange things in that book that you brought to light that a lot of people didn't know of. And including the assassination of Clark, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, no, Lewis, he was basically murdered.
I'm sorry, Lewis was assassinated.
Yep.
But my question is, did this book, Ancient Giants of America, come out of that research? Because I remember when we were talking about that, there were episodes, in fact, I think he even dedicated a chapter into running into these giant Native Americans. And was this book based on that research?
Well, actually, like that, the giant parts in that book was kind of the first. I mean, it came out before, you know, Dewhurst's book and everyone else's. That was kind of the first to reach, to kind of open and reach that level. I mean, that book sold like 30,000-40,000 copies. So, so this was definitely a continuation. I mean, I wrote a sequel to that one, The Suppressed History of American Banking, which came out like last month as well. And so there's a little bit more continuing in the story from the War of 1812 up. But yeah, definitely that sparked the seed that this would grow out of, the ancient giants in the Americas. And I just turned in one about giants in the Middle East and so forth. That's going to be coming out next year as well. So, I mean, I think I'm going to have the giants pretty much well covered in. But this one, my first book with New Page, and, you know, I have to say they did a fantastic job. And it's all there. It covers Canada, South America, and America. So it's
yeah,
there,
you even
man.
Cover Mexico, which we'll get into here in a minute.
Right.
But very interesting. And I don't know who did your cover, but that cover is fascinating, where you got the guy, the archaeologist, is standing in front of a foot from a dude that would probably be from that movie Jack the Giant Slayer.
They did an excellent job on the cover. I was very impressed.
That's a huge footprint.
Footprint, yeah. Well,
for those of you listening, the cover, this book just came out. Actually, it's coming out. Is it coming out? Is it out right now? Or is it coming out in a week?
Yeah, it's like next week, I think.
It's coming out in a week, so I got an advanced copy, and I'll put it up on the Facebook page. But it's really, really cool cover. Ancient Giants of the Americas. There's a huge, huge footprint from a dude that must be probably about 100 plus feet tall. And there's the archaeologist looking at it going, oh, man, what the hell happened here? So, and it's in stone, which means that the guy probably lived, you know, in the Paleolithic period or thousands of years ago. But so did you actually come across these chronicles in researching this book? I mean, in the earlier book, History of America, because this is what I want to talk about, which makes, again, your book quite fascinating, is that you get into these eyewitness accounts by the Spanish conquistadors that began coming to America through Florida. So were these documents that you found in resources like Library of Congress? Did you have to go to D.C. or something to find these documents? Because I'm just amazed by this.
Well, thankfully, with Google, everything is pretty much there. And you could, if you're looking for it, you know, you could find it. And I was able to find and read these conquistador accounts and then kind of trace them back to the archives in Sevilla in Spain. So they do exist. You know, these are from 1500s. They're super old. But, yeah, there is documents, especially when you're dealing with the conquistadors who came across. I mean, you got to understand that was basically untouched territory for a long time.
Yeah.
And with these giants, so to speak, that they were seeing, and most of the giants they would come across would be like the tribal chiefs. Like most of the chiefs were giants. It wasn't too many non-chiefs that were giants. Some of them were, I think, the Copacai and around the Texas area.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had a lot more of the population that was taller. But
yeah.
the giant chiefs were anywhere from, you know, 7 to 10 feet tall, and the average conquistador was like 5'3".
Why do you think that? And you write about this. Why was the chief this monstrous dude? Was that just how he inherited? Was he a special dude from
basically,
a tribe?
They were. It's kind of like everything in royalty, right? They always try to preserve a bloodline. So I think that the chiefs were the preserved bloodline from the prior giant civilization that had been in North America and the Americas. Of course, over time, the genes would be smaller. So you could kind of see how it could go from 12 feet, you know, after the flood to the ones that survived to dwindling down, you know, to 11, to 10, to 9, to 8, to 7, right? And I believe that these giant chiefs were the remaining results of those after effects. I mean, we, you know, in the introduction to the book, I talk a lot about the various humanoid species they're coming across all the time. You got the Denisovans, you know, who basically were cousins with the Neanderthals. And they had another cousin that they can't figure out who it was. You know, there's unknown DNA. Now they're having the Paracas skulls are showing that they also had the elongated skulls in Peru. They're showing that their DNA has more unknown characteristics. And they're finding, you know, 4-million-year-old bones in Ethiopia recently. The red cave deer people, I think, it was in Indonesia and you know, another couple million years old. And then the Hobbit, basically they had to admit that the Hobbit existed and was a whole other species apart from man. But so it brings credence to what Tolkien was writing about, because you understand J.R.R. Tolkien was in Cambridge or Oxford, you know, one of those. And he had access to all the manuscripts because he was, you know, one of the library heads. So he had access to everything, you know, ancient stuff. So he was reading a bunch of ancient things that probably would seem like fantasy, but I think what he was really doing was kind of putting together the true history of Earth, even though it would be considered alternate. But I think he was a lot closer than a lot of people give it credit for just being a work of fiction.
Yeah, so his fiction work was probably based on some of his some of the research he did.
Some of the research.
Yeah, which is fascinating. Hey, let's get into this. You start the book describing a journal that came out in the year 1542 by a guy named Kabazi Divaka, who wrote about his expeditions with a dude named Panfilio de Narraza, who landed in northern Florida. And he talks about encounters with giant Indians. And this is interesting because he talks about the size of these guys being 11 or 12 palms in height. And I looked that up, and that's basically the length of a hand spread out from finger to finger, from the small finger to the thumb, which is roughly a foot. So I'm thinking those guys are 11 feet tall, and that's pretty amazing. What, tell us a little bit about that guy, because that journal must have been mind-blowing.
Well, okay, so Kabazi Divaka's story is incredible. He left Cuba with, I think, Navarez, and, you know, go check out Florida. And when they got there, they discovered that the Indians in central Florida were huge, like you said. And basically, they ran out. They ran into a hurricane, and everyone except four people survived, and that would be Divaka, two other people, and then Estevanico, who is also known as the Moor, Stephen the Moor, right? So he's like basically the first African to enter Arizona, enter Texas, and all this, and he was a holy man, basically a shaman, because he was a Moor from Morocco, so he was like a wise man, basically, you know. And
why were they run out? Were they run out because they were trying to make peace with the Indians, and the Indians just didn't want to have anything with it, or did they piss the guy off?
The
Indians said, "You're dead," or something like that.
Well, basically, the conquistador missions, they were looking for gold, and they weren't finding anything, and so it kind of was. If they weren't finding gold, then they were finding slaves.
Yeah.
So, you know, basically it's always a fight. And I'm going to read a little bit from the book. There's an entry here. So Kabazi Divaka's story had all the exciting elements found in page-turning classics, plus extra special ingredients, such as battles in strange Florida jungles with giant Indians. And here's the excerpt. When we attempted to cross the large lake, now this is from the point of view of Divaka, when we attempted to cross the large lake, we came under heavy attack from many giant Indians concealed behind trees. Some of our men were wounded in this conflict, for which the good armor they wore did nothing. The Indians we had so far seen were all archers. They went naked in our large body and appear at a distance like giants. They are of admirable proportions, very spare, and of great activity and strength. The bows they use are thick as the arm, of 11 or 12 palms in length, which they discharge at 200 paces with so great precision that they miss nothing. So here's a firsthand eyewitness account of some giant archers.
And I guess their arrows were so big that it pierced the armor.
Huge, and coming so fast that it just went right through you.
So they took out a bunch of the Spanish pretty quickly, which is fascinating.
Very quickly.
Yeah. So you go on in the book, and later Hernando de Soto would come through after the survivors of that first group came in, and he's like, hey, I'm going to get these dudes. And he brings 9 ships with full, soldiers, I guess.
Yes, 600 men and 200 horses.
Go ahead.
600 men and 200 horses.
Oh, my God. So his goal was to get in there and get that gold, I guess. Huh? So what happened
with
him?
Get that gold. Well, same thing. He met the same fate. They go into Tampa Bay, and that's where they meet the giant chief, Kopafi, of the Apalachee. And that sparked a big uprising. So DeSoto had to chase Kopafi into the forest, which would be modern Tallahassee, before capturing and executing him. Now, this, of course, led them to Tuscaloosa, who was even more of a giant chief. And the giant chief's son who was almost as big as him. So when they got to Alabama, the Giant Chief's son in Tuscaloosa met them. And this is Rand Hell, who was basically the writer for the expedition, for DeSoto's expedition. He's the one who wrote everything, and this is his
right.
This is his entry. I'm going to read. We reached a hamlet, which though rightfully under his scepter, oft with treacherous arms his lawful sway had stubbornly withstood. A giant monarch, Tuscaloosa, ruled the neighboring kingdom, and he sowed abroad among the subjects of his brother prince disloyalty and discontent. Here came to meet us from the pathway to the west a warrior, naked as a god from heaven, scorning the fleecing drapery of the clouds. Only upon his brow were scarlet plumes plucked from the libis, where his careless hand swayed his spear lightly. So he's holding the spear. Seeing him, we paused, dumb with amazement. So he's like, seeing him, we paused, dumb with amazement. For though but a youth still in his April dawns, he towered on high, a great-limbed giant. Heads of tallest men reached only to his breast. Taking up our march, after 3 days, we reached a little town where the chief tarried. Pitching first our tents, the monarch next we sought. So basically, he sees the sun, they guide him into Tuscaloosa. The monarch next we sought, and soon descried and conceived before his wigwam. So basically, see him on his wigwam, because there's some words that are so old that, you know.
Yeah, they're probably
don't exist anymore. Right. So they see him before his wigwam on a mound, and 100 peers surrounding him, a giant mightier than his son. So he's like, I see this guy, a giant bigger than his son. So, I mean,
but
here
Tuscaloosa,
you go.
Chief Tuscaloosa was, I mean, if these guys, so he's maybe about 7'5" or something. Do you think he's bigger? Is he like 8 foot tall? He's like a, because I mean, the biggest
about 9 feet tall.
The biggest basketball player was like 7 feet, maybe 6'11".
Right. Well, Tuscaloosa was 9 feet tall.
Oh, he was 9 feet tall.
Yeah,
see, that's
his son was like
that's a big dude. That's a big
huge,
guy.
Huge, yeah. I mean, the tallest guy in the world now, I think, is like 8'7", 8'10", or something like that.
Yeah.
And you know, and basketball players, I mean, dude, basketball players, okay, they're some are 7 feet. But most of them are, you know, 6'10", 6'9", 6'8".
Yeah.
You know. So, I mean.
Okay, so I didn't get the part where you figured the count was like he was 9 feet, Chief Tuscaloosa. So he was huge. He was a big dude.
Yeah, he was huge.
And the other natives in that tribe, were they all pretty good-sized people too?
No, I think they were mostly regular size, but.
Okay.
The chief. Tuscaloosa and his son were huge.
Okay. Yeah,
because that's
so
how
this
most
gets
of them
back
were.
To this gets back to this thing about these chiefs. These chiefs are a special breed of human. And, I mean, it's almost like they developed their own tribe or something. Or would you say it's more like they were selected based on their great size, and maybe they're just very, very bright too. What do you think?
I think it just goes back to the lineage. You know, they're, you know, the chiefs maintain that certain lineage, and that's probably why they remain taller. That seems to make sense. You know, and because if you were born with, like, okay, say for instance, they always, anytime they find a giant skeleton or whatever, or a giant person, they're like, oh, this, he has a pituitary gland syndrome or whatever, right?
Yeah, right.
So if that existed back then, there would be other tribal members who were like, whoa, 10 feet tall also. But it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Only the chiefs were, and the offspring. So, you know, that alone should let you know that certain, has to be some point of line of that giant, you know, lineage somewhere that they kept alive. And, you know, also we talk about in this book, you know, the copper mining giants from the Bronze Age period up in Michigan. And we know that they mined so much copper from that area, but they have no idea where it went. And then they try to tell you that in Europe, all of it came from some certain mines, you know, around England or whatever, but they know it's not true. because there's way more copper than that those mines could have ever produced.
Mm-hmm.
And who's to say that those Bronze Age giants of the, you know, upper Midwest didn't come down and, you know, mingle and you know,
mm-hmm.
with the population, native population that was already there. I mean, they found a Lovelock Cave in Nevada, and those were the some of the cannibal giants that you're talking about earlier.
Yeah.
You know, the Paiute Indians talk about them, and they even found them. And even the oldest duck decoy in existence is from the Lovelock Cave, you know, thousands of years old when there was actually water in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's all very interesting.
Did any of these guys, any of these conquistadors, chronicle conversations with these chiefs to know and learn how long they've been living in that part of Florida? I mean, has it been, were they descendants of an earlier people, or did they migrate up from somewhere or down from somewhere to kind of land?
No, there was no real conversations like that in the conquistador accounts, in the early conquistador accounts, other than just seeing them. We know, like, when the most famous, probably, and the best preserved first-hand account was Amerigo Vespucci, when he went to the island of Curaçao, which is off the coast of Venezuela. He called it the Island of Giants because he, you know, saw the footprints, followed them in, and then he found a village, you know, with the women who were tall as well. And then when the giant men came, you know, kind of because they were looking how they could kidnap some of the women, but when the men came and they saw how big they were, it kind of put a monkey wrench in their plans, and they they backed off quietly and wrote about
it.
You know? But there was no, you know, the later, because the later histories, and there's a chapter in here that talks about the Native American myths and such, they come afterwards, but even the natives, they have the history of the giants, but they all say that, you know, they don't know where they come from. And then as far the mound builders and everything else, you know, they all attributed them to the giants. Even though school they teach you, like, oh, don't worry, the natives built it, you know. When the natives themselves said, nah, we didn't, you know.
They inherited those. You describe, you know, it's funny because you're talking about just the chiefs being monsters, but you describe the discovery of thousands of giant skeletons in the mid-1800s that were found in Lake Okeechobee, which is in Florida. And
oh, yeah, they found Bobby.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because, I mean, we're not talking about one or two. Apparently, something happened where the lake was drained or it was something happened, and they found thousands of these monstrosities.
Well, the settlers who came to Florida in the 1800s, you know, they were learning about the urban legends, claiming that an ancient race of giants, you know, once had been in Florida. And some of these early accounts talk about the thousands of giant skulls floating on the surface of Lake Okeechobee. And that was from, you know, 1800s they're talking about that. So when the drought hit in 2007, the water receded so low that they found a whole cemetery full of skeletons. Each one was at least 7 feet high. So the massive skulls, you know, they even found elongated skulls as well. So, I mean, that was there. That's something that happened. Who knows? You know, a lot of times you read this stuff and you read the reports and it's like there's something amazing. Like, oh, they found, you know, 13-foot skull or skeleton buried in a mound or whatever. And then that's pretty much where it ends, because usually Smithsonian comes involved, and, you know, the last you heard is like, oh, it goes off to Smithsonian for more studying. Then you never hear anything else about it. So, you know, we're in a position where discovery of these things are so upsetting to the apple cart that mostly all we're gonna get is the initial report.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Hey, if you're enjoying this program, and this is a great show today, I really appreciate our guest. Gaia our sponsor is putting on a fantastic offer. And if you go to Gaia.com/Earth Ancients, they have a special page with tons of these authors who are talking about alternative history. You got Graham Hancock, Nassim Harriman. But what I want to bring up is Dave Wilcox has a new Pyramid Power series that is available. And if you join this month, it's 99 cents to start. And then like I think it's about $9 for the rest of your time as a member. You can get that. Just go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. There's hundreds of very, very amazing speakers, researchers, authors. And it's like it's money well spent. So they sponsor us. I hope you'll join them and check it out. 99 cents for the first month. I want to talk a little bit about this geologist, and this is something that you bring up, but he is quite unique. His name is E.A. Is it Sellards?
Yeah, and I was just about to mention we should talk about this guy, E.A. Sellards.
This is what's unique. He believes, and I don't. This is amazing that you found this, but he believes that that tribe, those people, had been there 125,000 years. Now, I don't think they had carbon dating when he was around, so I don't know how he calculated this. How did he come up with that number?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
This is the early 1900s, so I'm not sure. Maybe
Early 1900s, excuse me. Okay.
This is 1917, so
okay.
However he was able to come up with that, maybe the layers of strata, I think that's how they
so it was buried underground so many feet and they measured the strata,
right.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
Well, let me read a little bit from the report, because he saw the excavation in Vero Beach, and mm-hmm. one of the skeletons they unearthed was 12 feet height, so and here's the report, that human beings inhabited the North American continent more than has been conclusively proven, though a recent discovery in the state by E.H. Sellards, state geologist and professor Oliver P. Hay, who have made a study of the fossil. Though their opinions are not fully concurred by other scientists, they are positive their researches have been thorough and there is no room for mistake. The discovery was made several months ago, and though nothing of a definitive nature had been given out until recently, it is now officially stated that the human bones intermingle with those of a mastodon, a saber-toothed tiger, and many other extinct animals that formerly ranged this hemisphere have been found. The deposit was found near Vero Beach. That the human beings were of enormous size is evidenced by the bones. It is thought that some were 10 or 12 feet in height. Some excellent specimens of the skeleton of these gigantic men have been found, some of them locked in the deadly embrace of great animals with strange weapons of bone clutched in skeleton hands a foot long. So basically, they found mastodon tusks with carvings on them.
You know, right.
Along with giant skeletons.
This guy is an official geologist.
Oh, yeah.
And here is a report showing modern humans in America 125,000 years ago.
Yeah,
but nobody talks about this because it must really, been current history pretty far.
Well, yeah, they were basically forced out of their positions and had to relocate.
Oh, he was
they're fired.
Fired.
Yep.
That's happened before with some academics who came up with research that kind of countered the general theme of history.
But check this out. 90 years later, and I've talked to this guy, 90 years later, amateur fossil hunter discovered the carved mastodon bone in the same area, right? And after 3 years of scientific studying the fossil, science claimed it to be the oldest, most spectacular, and rare work of art in the Americas. However, there was no mention of the ancient giant bones discovered in the same strata. So, there you go.
Well, I mean, that's a good piece of research on your part. And I think you do have some photos of some skulls that are some skeletons are there. kind of showing. But I guess that we get back to the point of contention, and this is what other authors say, is that we don't have evidence of it because it was the, I guess, sworn duty by the scientists and the administrators of the Smithsonian Institute to go out and whatever it costs, buy these bones and skeletons and bring them back to be stored in their institute.
And lose them.
Yeah.
Because those bones were conveniently lost after arriving at the Smithsonian in 1945.
Oh, so they actually traced where they were picked up by the Smithsonian and then...
And lost them. You can read a lot of those reports end with Smithsonian, you know, took the bones or whatever, and that's it. Like, I don't know.
You know, I was reading somewhere, and I've had somebody write to me that, and I've read, like, again, I've read a couple of articles that the Smithsonian, the current keepers of the archives, have said that over the years they've gotten rid of all the bones, and they, you know, they honestly don't have, and it's hard to say if they're truthful or not, but they're saying, hey, we don't have any giant bones. We don't know what you're talking about. That's all fallacy. But how could it be fallacy if book after book after article talks about them picking up these giant skeletal remains and artifacts and shipping them back to Washington? It just doesn't make sense.
And this is the problem we have with in government and trusting the government. That's why Congress has an 8% approval rating. That's why Trump got elected, because people are just sick of the lies. They're sick of the whole ordeal. Tell me why. You know, and some of them I can see it's been a long period of time, and you know, maybe over those periods that they've had been destroyed. And have gone missing and disappear. Yeah. I would assume most of them disappear into like private collectors and you know, who knows, like props for occult rituals and stuff like that. Who knows, right? So I could see how some in the Smithsonian aren't going to know because they're probably too new, you know.
Yeah.
But the fact is that with so many reports, it's just, come on, man. You know, it's just, that's the proof. You know,
well, I was thinking initially thinking that, okay, well, wait a minute, you know, bones are organic. Maybe they just eventually turn into dust once they're exposed to the air and all that kind of stuff. But
most of the
giant
bones do when they're on Earth.
That's only good for a few. There's a couple of these that are actually been petrified because they're so old, you know, and so
old, right.
it's like rock, but you know, so where in the hell did those go?
Especially if it's that old, you know. It's going to be a rock, so that's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah. And then
here, continue on, talks about your neck of the woods over in Mexico City, which you're interested in. In the 60s, amateur archaeologist Juan Camacho discovered an engraved mastodon bone near the Velasquillo Reserve in Mexico City. A team from Harvard showed up and began excavating the site, eventually finding some of the oldest spearheads in the world and more carved bones. The team put forth peer-reviewed studies postulating the age of the artifacts at more than 40,000 years, which is three times older than the official 12,000-year-old date for the first Americans. An exciting discovery for everyone involved. But when the United States Geological Survey geologists examined the artifacts and the site, they had a much more mind-blowing age, dating the site and the artifacts at more than 250,000 years old.
Oh my God!
Yeah, I mean, what's going on here? You know,
I think that I don't know if it's going to be in our lifetime or not, but there's going to have to be a revolution in understanding our history, because keeping suppressing known and unknown civilizations because it doesn't fall in line with the current historical record. It just doesn't make sense. And I've even heard scientists tell me that, and they don't tell me this directly, but they say that when they do carbon dating, you have an ability to plus or minus the date up to many thousands of years. And in some cases, it's been not documented, but dates taken back, dates that are unacceptable by current orthodoxy, when they're carbon dating, have been corrected to so that they do fall in line. So say the skeleton, modern human dates to carbon dates to say 100,000 years, and they're saying, well, no, it can't be that much, so we got to dial it down a little bit. So, I mean, that kind of stuff really bothers me if that's the case. But hey, in light of your paycheck, if you're getting a paycheck from a university, if you're going to be spilling the beans, that's probably, you know, you don't want to lose your job. So
that's what it is, man. Because, you know, the institution, right? So you are dependent on that paycheck. You got mortgage, you got family, you got bills.
Yeah.
And if you're an archaeologist or whatever, like, that's the only place you can work. It's not like, okay, you know, you get fired and you can go look for a job somewhere. Nah, dude, you literally have only one place you can work. So, you know, unless it's a museum, and if you got fired from there, they're not, definitely won't take you at no museum. So,
yeah.
You're pretty much, your hands are tied, and this is the reason why this stuff is forgotten about. It's not taught. You know, it remains conspiratorial, or you're crazy, you know. But how exciting is it to talk about ancient giants? Like, how cool is that? No one even really, like, if you mention that to the normal person, like the average person, they wouldn't even, like, register it as, like, what? What are you talking about?
Exactly. Yeah. You know? Well, there's ancient aliens on TV. I'm sure they bring it up. But hey, let's talk about another really interesting Spanish traveler that you highlight in your book, Francisco Coronado. And he, interestingly enough, came up from Mexico into what is now Arizona, looking for El Dorado. What is looking for El Dorado? What is the El Dorado?
Oh, man, El Dorado, basically, it would be Chichimozoc, or the seven cities of gold, or the seven caves of gold, or Cibola. They're all the same thing. And it's basically a city of gold with the golden walls and all that in a cave. So in a series of caves, there's El Dorado. And I think basically, you know, from the research I've done and the work I'm involved in with the Dutchman in mind, that it seems to be that this was sort of a solar flare type of something to protect against that, I guess. You know,
what do you
in
mean,
ancient times.
Solar flare. What do you mean?
Well, since if gold protects against solar flares, like radiation to that level,
mm-hmm.
and we know that because everything goes in space usually has to have gold on it. So if the ancient Aztecs or you know, the ancient giants or whoever the Aztecs got their culture from knew about this, that a calamity was coming, you know, maybe they had built this solar, you know, this cave of gold to protect them from the solar wave that was about to hit. And then they kind of emerged out after the devastation. Because this is what all the native myths talk about, you know. They
mm-hmm.
they emerged from a cave, right, a sacred cave. So maybe this was, maybe this has something to do with it, and this is why gold is so revered to them.
So El Dorado is like a city of gold in Arizona that Coronado was looking for, or he had heard about, or what?
Well, they would look for it in Peru, and basically they didn't find it, but Marcus de Niza, who was part of that little expedition, he had all the knowledge. So he was the one who determined that it had to have been not in Peru, but maybe in Mexico. So he went down to Mexico, and this is where he met Coronado. And Coronado was just a rich playboy who was, you know, just hanging out, having a good time, until he met de Niza, and de Niza kind of figured that with some of the knowledge she got, because in Mexico, that's where he met Stephen the Moor, Estevanico, who was one of the survivors of the Dabaca mission, right? Expedition. So he already known about where it was, basically, 'cause from going going west and ending up in Arizona and then mingling. I mean, there's a whole bunch of, you know, Indians that he was like a godlike figure because he was like one of the first black people they ever saw. So, and he was a shaman and he was a healer. So this guy was, you know, he knew a lot. So when he told Deniza that he knew where the true El Dorado was, Deniza listened, and then they went to Coronado. And Coronado financed a little mission first, like a little stakeout to see before the big expedition, right? Mm-hmm. And they basically, and this is what they don't teach you, because they teach you that Coronado went west of the superstition. He never made it to the superstitions, and then went west around the Gila River and up into like New Mexico. But he actually went right over it, right through there, because that's where Stephen Amor and Marcus Deniza went, you know, right? And the problem was you had the Zunis, who were fiercely, you know, the Apaches, Zunis, who protected that, because it was, if that was their sacred homeland, and they knew El Dorado was in that area, you know, gold meant nothing to them, but the history did. So they basically killed Estevanico, and Deniza was able to escape, but he figured that's, you know, he thought he had seen something on the cliff. He thought he had seen a glimmering of something, and that's, you know, what he was able to tell Coronado. Now, when Coronado went, you know, he gathered, what, 1,000 Indians and his troops and a bunch of, like, 600 animals. You know, it was, like, this big expedition to up through California and into Arizona. Mm-hmm. And when he met, when he got, when he went into there, he had other scouts who were sending ships up the Gulf, up the coast, right, to meet him with provisions. And they encountered, and this is a first-hand encounter that's in the book, the Tuburon Indians, who were, you know, 10 feet tall. And he even brought one of them back to meet Coronado.
Okay, wait a minute now. You talk about that, and that was my next question. These were a native tribe called Tuburon?
Yeah, these were, okay, and they were finding their 10-foot skeletons way after, even in the early 1900s. And this would be around, you know, in that little area of, where is it, the Baja, I guess? Is that the Baja area?
Oh, I thought you said Arizona, so I was a little confused about that.
That's how they were going. Like, if you go up through Arizona, comes through Mexico, right? So if you go...
Right.
If you go in that little, there was more water then, right? So if you go into the bay right there, it's basically on the same, it's right there. I mean, Arizona, Mexico, California is all the same. So they were going through up through Arizona, but they had the ships going up in the bay, which is pretty much California. It's in the Baja area, I think. And then the Tuburon Indians were from that area. So that's when they brought him over to meet Coronado before he got into Arizona. Because, you know, to get out of Mexico, you still got to go through California.
Right. And so these are 10-foot tall natives. I mean, that's huge. That's
huge.
A 10-foot tall person is like, I can't even imagine.
No, that's just massive. Let's see here. So it was Don Rodrigo Maldonado, who was captain of those who went in search of the ships. And he did not find them, but he brought back with him an Indian so large and tall that the best man in the army reached only his chest. And it was said that the other Indians were even taller on the coast. So according to historians, the giant Indian was the Siri, a great giant tribe that occupied the island of Tiburon and the adjacent Sonora coast on the Gulf of California. So that was that area. Now, in the meantime, Coronado was marching into New Mexico while Captain Melchior Diaz was trying to establish contact. So they're all looking for each other, but they never came across each other.
Oh, right.
And Diaz talks about another tribe of Indians. And this is Castaneda's report. They came to a province of exceedingly tall and strong men, like giants. They are naked and live in strong cabins, built underground like smokehouses with only the straw roof above the ground. They enter these at one end and come out the other. More than 100 persons, old and young, sleep in one cabin. When they carry anything, they take a load of more than 300 or 400 weight on their heads. Once when our men wished to fetch a log for the fire, and 6 men were unable to carry it, one of these Indians is reported to have come and raised it in his arms, put it on his head alone, and carried it very easily.
God.
That's insane, dude.
You know, and why I would love to see the remains of one of these guys. 10 foot tall. I mean, how much is that? That's probably like probably weighs 10 feet tall. Is it? If 7 feet is about 200 to 320 pounds, so 10 foot would probably be 600 or 500
pounds. Yeah, man, crazy. That's a lot.
I mean,
of strength.
That's a lot of flesh.
Wow. And you know, and when they did unearth some of the skeletons and graves in the in California, I think in Northern California, because when Magellan came to San Francisco, I mean, he saw the giant Indians too, and he talked about it. So there are pictures of those excavations, I think, from the early 1900s, showing 10-foot tall skeletons. But I think all those bones, like everything else, just disappeared, man.
I'm amazed that we don't have evidence of these guys. You have in your book, and I don't know where you got this photograph. You probably must have gone through the archives. The Washington Times in 1908 had an article about two skeletons, a couple that were found in some part of California, I think, and they were each 10 feet tall, and they were buried together. Can you talk a little bit about that and what part of where they were found?
I think that was what I was mentioning earlier, and it's above. I think it's around the San Francisco area. I don't know for exactly. I have to.
So look. Actually, it wasn't like on the Farallon Islands, which is outside of the Golden Gate, which would be the Golden Gate Bridge. Just a little group of islands now, but I mean,
it might be.
Okay, because I know down in. There's the islands off of L.A. where they found bones, and then the Santa Rosa Islands where they found recently they found a mastodon elephant remains, which are thousands of years old, and so they're basically showing another period with these monstrous people and these very very old animals, megafauna, as they call them, elephants, saber-toothed tigers, sloths, these big, big animals that lived tens of thousands of years ago. So these people are long-lived, very long-lived. That's fascinating.
It might have been either San Diego, might have been, because they found some tall giants in San Diego, mm-hmm. or it... It could have been the Tiburon Island as well. I mean, it might have actually been that. I think that's what the report was from, because it says here, our final California entry is attributed to Coronado and his men. It is discovered that validates Castaneda's claim that the Tiburon Island giants were indeed massive, especially into the short-standing conquistadors. In quotes, the Department of Agriculture received yesterday from an agent on Tiburon Island, Gulf of California, the skeleton of a primitive man more than 10 feet tall. So, yeah, I think. And other bones similar size were encountered, so I think that's it. I think it was that area.
Now, your book is filled with different parts of the world. You got Canada in here. You got the United States is covered very well. Mostly... And it's funny that the Spanish had such great chronicles. I think De Soto had a secretary with him, and that person's job was just to chronicle the trip. But it looks like the Spanish were much better than anybody else who came to what was known as Norte Americana, North America, United States today, and actually chronicled their trip. So Now Lewis and Clark ran into the Giants. Was it in Washington or was it on the way to Washington in your first book? I can't remember.
Well, basically they didn't encounter they encounter some giant tribal members, like giant, more taller, but they didn't encounter nothing spectacular. Yeah, but they were but they encountered the Mandan Indians, which were the Welsh, which basically proves that, you know, there was pre-Columbian contact. And they wrote about that extensively, you know, about the Welsh Indians, and that's something they were looking for. Most of what they might have encountered, we don't know, because a lot of the journal entries went missing or were edited, or, you know, who knows. So we can't say for certain what exactly they found, but you know, the conquistadors down in Mexico, there's just a ton of information about all the giant shenanigans that was going down there. And so it's the conquistadors, you know, they were the first to document the bison, the buffalo, a bunch of things. I mean, the fact that they actually wrote everything down and documented it, it's very incredible, the only thing that kind of sucks is how they treated the histories of the natives, of the Native Americans, especially in Mexico with the Mayans. I mean, we have very little that survived, and they only survived because a few monks were, smart enough to kind of preserve what they were destroying.
I'm just blown away by these accounts, and there's no bones to show these guys, where they are. Let's talk about Mexico. You go into a great deal about Mexico, and in the opening of your chapter called Giants of Mexico, you describe an Aztec mythology of giants who may have survived the Great Flood and either built Teotihuacan or they came back and rebuilt it. Now, Teotihuacan is a very interesting place, and I haven't been there yet, but I'm hoping to go there one of these days soon. But those pyramids, the Pyramid of the Sun and the Pyramid of the Moon, and a lot of the adjacent pyramids are monstrously big. I mean, very, very, very big. And what's your feeling on those? What do you believe is the truth about that?
I would love to see them as well. I think those are around Mexico City, that area.
Yeah, they're south of Mexico City. I'm gonna try to make it and get a trip in a year or so to go down there. Yeah, Teotihuacan is south of Mexico City by, I think it's a half an hour drive.
Half an hour, right? And then Cancun, I think, is where like the Pyramid of the Sun is, the Snake Pyramid or whatever, where the
Yucatan is Maya. Teotihuacan is attributed to Aztec, but it's not. That's different. Yucatan is a northern Mexico, the tip peninsula, the Yucatan Peninsula, and that's a whole different kind of a pyramid complex. I mean, and I've been to Yucatan many, many times. That complex design is unique to the Maya, who engineered them specifically based on the limestone that they found there. Teotihuacan is constructed with different types of natural rock, dirt, and when they first found it, it had mica on many of the pyramids. So, but tell us about what you discovered on Teotihuacan, because I thought that was fascinating.
Well, to me, all that, those ancient megalithic type of things, you know, are directly related to some sort of giant antediluvian culture. So when I looked into the Aztec mythology, you know, by way of the Vatican A Codex or the Codex Rios, which was written during the Spanish conquest by the Dominican friar working in Puebla, in Oaxaca. So basically they talk about the Quinametzin, who they called the Old Ones, and they related that they were giants. Now, these Quindamenton were giants that survived the floods and either regrouped and built or rebuild the ancient city of Teotihuacan and the Great Pyramid of Cholula. So Teotihuacan was known as the place where men became gods and
right.
spread out so that the pyramids and mounds correlate a map of the solar system. I mean, how crazy is that? So besides being built by giants, Teotihuacan has other strange anomalies associated, such as the presence of large quantities of mica. Now, mica, like you mentioned earlier, is a mineral that is only found 3,000 miles away in Brazil, but yet somehow managed to make its way to almost every building in Teotihuacan.
Yep.
I mean, explain that.
Well, we now know that through digging, at least at the Pyramid of the Moon and the Serpent Pyramid, that those were some kind of generators because they found tons of liquid mercury in each of
yep.
those. And also they found waterways, and there was a technology involved basically that either mixed the water with the mercury. And on top of that, John Burke has discovered, and he passed away a few years ago, that that pyramid was built over a geomagnetic field. So here you got naturally occurring electromagnetic field capturing whatever chemical mixture is in the water, the mercury, maybe some other chemicals, and pulses up and generates some kind of energy or bathes, or we don't know what the hell it does. It's so beyond us. Right now, archaeologists kind of scratch their heads and go, hey, what's so much liquid mercury here?
Yeah, and then they found the pyrite-covered yellow orbs, all those little balls. So
yeah.
You got mercury, you got little yellow balls covered in pyrite. Yeah, they have no idea what's
going on.
At all.
That's a whole different paradigm where energy was manufactured through natural occurring electromagnetic fields, and I'm going to be writing about that. In fact, I've started writing about it. It's pretty amazing. But
amazing.
I want you to talk about this one passage in here. The son of Spanish priest Diego Duran grew up in central Mexico and was familiar with the remaining giant Indians that were in that close area. That's another eyewitness account of giant Indians. How big were these guys?
I think they would all be about 9 to 10 feet too. I mean, Duran was given firsthand. He had firsthand opportunity to learn about the Aztecs and the early indigenous history of Mexico, and he became a recognized expert on language, customs, and the pre-Columbian history of Mesoamerica. Okay, so he basically spent 33 years with the natives. And before returning to Spain to write about him, he basically learned how to interpret the hieroglyphs and the stories of the giants were not only passed down, but he saw them, firsthand. According to Aztec history, the lands of central Mexico were completely ruled by a race of giants until local tribes joined forces and ran them out of the area. Duran writes that once the tribes had won a few victories and began to settle. So he says, those from the first region were Chichimecs, and the people from Puebla and Cholula were the giants, the Quiname, which means men of great stature. The other people who were found in Tlaxcala and Cholula, and Huexitzinco, were also said to have been giants. These were enraged at the coming of the invaders and tried to defend their land. Of the battles that the Chulucs fought with the giants until they killed them or drove them away from the country, these giants lived no less basically than the Chichimecs, as they had abominable customs and ate raw meat from the hunt. In certain places of the region, enormous bones of the giants have been found, which I myself have seen dug up at the foot of cliffs many times. So here he's describing how they had to basically fight off the giants who survived, and they were cannibalistic giants. And then he's given you a first-hand account of some of the bones they dug up from the bottoms of the cliffs after, a good way to kill a bunch of people would be to just basically run them off a cliff, right? And then, years later, he's digging up the giant bones that remained. So it's some crazy stuff there.
It's so interesting. I've been to the I don't know if you've been to Mexico before, but in Mexico City there's the Anthropological Museum, which is basically filled with artifacts from ancient Mexico. And I remember, I mean, I've been there a couple of times. It's fascinating. The stoneworks alone are worth the visit. If you guys, if whoever's listening, if you ever get a chance to go to Mexico, you have to go to the Anthropological Museum. It's just, it's just amazing because it's a stonework. I mean, the craftsmanship is just beyond our understanding. They had to use tools of some kind of machine driven, power driven velocity. But I remember seeing some artifacts that seemed awfully big. And I don't remember if it was bowls, but it seemed like there was like a carving tool or something that seemed like something was so damn big. Someone made it so big. It was like, the hell is going on? But I don't remember having an interest in giants. I haven't been down there in like 6 or 7 years. But it would make sense that if there were that many tribal people there, especially in close to Mexico City, that we would see something in the museums. But God, it just doesn't appear that there is anything. Because, I mean, I have a lot of people that listen that send me information from Mexico. I guess those of you listening, if you do know of anybody who or any museums out there, hey, let me know. Send me an email, cliff@earthancients.com, because I'd sure like to see a skeleton from one of these giant Indians. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I've only been to the border towns. I haven't actually been to see any of those megalithic works or any of the pyramids. But yeah, I come across the same thing in Ecuador with the velocity of giants over there, and there's a huge wall that they try to say, oh, it's just, you know, it's natural or whatever. But you could definitely see it was some sort of made wall, and then you have these massive stone axe, giant, you know, giant axes that, you know, super heavy, and then how would you even want to use it?
Let's talk about that, because you have a whole section in your book about Peru, and you actually show one of these gigantic axes. It's an axe head, and whoever was swinging this thing must have been huge. Talk a little bit about this is actually a museum in Ecuador. This photograph came from this axe head. Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, basically, my boy Bruce Fenton down there, he was the one kind of checking it out, and he was able to provide me some of these images of the giant axe head in the Museum of Aboriginal Cultures in Cuenca, Ecuador. Now, they just had a huge earthquake around there, so, you know, it very interesting timing. But, yeah, you could see these in the book, the axe hand, your hand is basically half of, not even half, but, like, barely a corner of the whole total width of the head. And, yeah, these were found in Ecuador, and that whole area, you know, South America with Peru, I mean, you have a lot of the giant, some of the giant history. When you get down into Patagonia region, right, into, I guess it would be Argentina, and going towards, like, going to the Arctic, to the South Pole, you know, in the early 1900s, there was a race of what they call the Patagonia Giants. And, you know, these were massive, you know, super tall, 10-foot Indians. So it exists, man. It's there. And with this book, people will be able to get a better understanding of what really went down and what really existed. And we have the facts. We have the reports. We have pictures. You know, we have the eyewitness accounts, right? But I guess it's just to the point of hammering academia to take a look, more serious look at these, some of these things, you know, and not make it all just swept under the rug like they did immediately in Ecuador. I mean, there should be a picture of the wall in the book, but I mean, it's obviously not natural. It's and the axe, you cannot explain why they would have giant axe heads. I mean, this doesn't make any sense.
I have to say this about academics, though. I have to say this about academics in South America. They are much more open to understanding the evidence of their research rather than covering it up. If they find bones, if they find artifacts that date into, and they have, they there's been skeletons and mummified cultures found throughout Peru that date man's inhabitation of the Americas into I think it's like 50 to 60,000 years ago. And we're talking very sophisticated men and women with, you know, very, very ornate pottery and artifacts and things like that. So I really like to hear those kind of things. It's funny that science in the North America, specifically the United States, tend to be less sympathetic towards these types of discoveries and tend to be more negative and shun the research of scientists outside of the border. And I just don't get that. It should be more of a complementary joining of forces rather than a rejection of data just because it doesn't fall in line with the current historical perspective. And it's unfortunate, and that's just the way it is, and it just takes a long time for the record books to in the history to change with new information. It's just kind of sad.
It is. It's frustrating, but it's why I do what I do, you know, to try to keep it out
keep
there.
People's eyes
keep
open.
People and yeah, exactly.
All right, so the last thing I want to talk about before we jump off is your research in Paracas, Peru. And, of course, we know we've had people talk about the Paracas culture. Most notable in that research is the guy named Brian Forrester, who I've talked about before as being – he frustrates the hell out of me because rather than get the permission from the government to get a complete skeletal remain – from one of these Paracas people, he decides to go ship it off DNA to America, which has been good, but he's just, I'm sorry. I mean, there's so many better avenues he could have gone to get. I mean, I've seen...
he seems to be playing like the academic card for some reason.
Pardon me?
He seems to be playing up to them, you know, instead of actually taking it to them.
I don't know the guy. I'm not a fan. I have to be honest with you. I'm not a fan of his work. I think he's presented some really important stuff, but he needs to sit with the guy because it's against the law to pull a skeleton of one of these people out from the ground because they're considered sacred and it's a cultural thing. But if he were to get serious and get a pathologist to come with him to sit down and get a group of scientists to analyze one of these skeletons, I think we have our eyes open. But hey, I don't want to go on. Talk a little bit about what you've discovered with these Paracas beings because they're fascinating.
Well, I mean, basically, I probably know what you know, except for maybe a little more. They have. I know by researching this, you know, most of the work comes from Pazansky, right? Arthur Pazansky, who was the first there in Tiwanaku, I guess.
Tiwanaku and also Pumapuku, I think.
Pumapuku, it's kind of like they're looking at this lost culture that are kind of the same things, you know, like with Paracas, you have the long elongated skulls. With the red hair, right? This ties into what I was talking about earlier in the book with the Bronze Age copper mining giants who were described similarly. And we also find in Florida, same thing, ancient, elongated skull, red-haired people, red-haired skulls. So, you know, his DNA work, I think, showed that there is something other than, you know, there is something they don't understand that could be alien. There's something else that's not in the records, but if you look at Pazansky's work in Bolivia, which, you know, takes the cake, man, Pumapunku with the megalithic, you know, the stone works over there.
Yeah.
Just obliterate anything they could try to tell you that how they're made with chisels and copper hammers or whatever. It's absolutely
awesome. It's like, and for those of you who don't know about the Pumapunku, it's a ruin in Bolivia, and the foundations, the walls, the superstructures, and most of the blocks that are left to us are cut with a level of precision that no one can understand. And we're talking about engineers. Yeah, for our current technology doesn't understand. So what it shows is that somebody with extremely advanced science and technology and tools cut.
Just like little drill holes, man. You can see it. Yeah. It's absolutely mind-boggling. Yeah. But in the same area when they found this, they found elongated skulls and they found giants. They found, you know, like I think it was a 10-foot or 11-foot giant skeleton in the same vicinity. So, you know, you kind of connect the dots and then be like, well, either someone's time traveling, maybe some time travelers, you know, like, I don't know how to, like, like their car broke down or something and their DeLorean broke down. And they had to, like, you know, do some stone smelting with, who knows? It's so beyond anything that makes sense.
Yeah.
And you know, and the book I just turned in that talks about, you know, over in the Middle East and stuff, you know, in Cairo and Egypt and all that. I was gonna do something on Turkey, but there wasn't enough information to do a full chapter, so I left it out. But there's an area in Turkey near the Armenian border, a tribute to the Uritarian civilization, and the fortress they left behind is literally like what you see in Pumapunku. Amazing, out of place. Fine, the rocks are just, it's incredible. The right angles and the straight edge and the cutting surfaces look just, you just can't. It boggles the mind, man. Some of these megalithic. And then you got the issue of the clamps, the T clamps, right?
Yeah, you have a section on that. That's pretty cool. Yeah,
that is cool. Unbelievable because you can find that in a lot of places. And I have the sketchbooks from Chepez from the 1800s. You know, where you could see them drawing it, and you know they're in like Persepolis and Iran, they're in Crete, and you can see the clamps.
Talk a little bit about the clamps. What are the clamps?
I mean, the clamps, they don't, I think David Hatcher might have got one that was still around, but basically they're pretty much non-existent. But the when you see these megalithic boulders, these blocks, some of them look like they were held together by T-clamps because of the way the indentions are in the stone, like they were poured in there, and somehow these clamps kept them together.
Right.
And you can find this in all, usually most of the ancient megalithic works all over the world, you'll find evidence of these T-clamps. So it kind of, you know, brings the whole notion that there were no transatlantic voyages, there was no pre-Columbian visitations, there was, you know, mankind were isolated, like they teach you the isolationist theory, basically like we all kind of grew up and developed on our own. But maybe we didn't, because why are there T-clamps and megalithic structures all over the world? And who put them there? You know, so basically, kind of everything they teach us has been lies. And it's pretty easy for them to actually rewrite and kind of take a look at this information and reconstruct what we think we know. And it's about time they start doing that, because, I mean, you know, history needs to be rewritten, basically. And it's all about history, man. Everybody's history. So it belongs to us all, man. We all have the right to know it, you know. Now they have the divide and conquer going so well with the, you know, with the race relations at an all-time worst and everything else that's been going on with this election, and the country is just so divided like never before. You know, once you realize that, hey, there might have been ancient aliens and giants and you know, megalithic stone builders with advanced ancient technology from Pluto or whatever, all those other issues start to become a little less relevant, you know.
That's true. I mean, you want to be comfortable in your own world. But that's the beauty of Ancient Alien, or excuse me, Earth Ancients, this program, is we focus on known and unknown civilizations, earthbound civilizations, and the off-world brothers come into the picture occasionally, but we don't concern ourselves too much with that because there's a lot going on in our own.
We're right here on Earth, exactly.
Yeah. There's a lot happening here. Hey, it's been great having you. The book's called Ancient Giants of the Americas, Suppressed Evidence, and the Hidden History of a Lost Race. My guest today has been Xavier Hayes. Xavier is getting to be a prolific writer. It seems like every time I talk to him, it's like, hey, Cliff, I got a new book. It's like, it's great that you can keep pumping these out, and I think it's great that you're in the flow, and I look forward to your next book. What is your website so people can go check you out?
Well, I mean, xavianvision.com is the archive where I have...
Okay, that's your archive.
All kinds of... Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of knowledge there that people can check it out. But, I mean, usually I just... You can find me on Facebook or, you know, go to Amazon is always the best place to get the books. So if you just kind of search...
And I'm going to post some photographs from the book. You got this wall of the giants in Ecuador. I forgot about that. We didn't get a chance to talk about that. There's so much in this book that is so unique. And the reason that it's unique is that Xavier's actually taking photographs of evidence of giants and their artifacts. I mean, giant stone heads, axe heads, parts of ruins, Pumapuku. Pumapuku is pretty amazing. And then he's actually got skeletons from fairly recent photographs into the 1900s, 1916, and so on and so forth. So it's probably the most present book on giants that is out there. And not to put the other ones down, I think those are all fine works, but the reason I like this book is that he has firsthand accounts by people that met with these giant humans, and it makes it quite interesting. So, hey, much success to you on this book, guy.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much. And, the book's short. It's entertaining. There's pictures, you know. It's meant to be fun, you know, and a quick read and open your mind, you know.
Yeah, it's perfect. Hey, have a great holiday, buddy, and we'll be in touch, okay?
I will be. I'm going to see Stonehenge, man. I'm going to be in Thanksgiving. I'm going to be in London for, like, Thanksgiving week, and I'm going to see Stonehenge.
Dude,
so
fantastic.
I'll let you know, man.
So we can see some photos on your Facebook page.
Yeah, man, you'll be checking it out. I'll do a little report exclusively for Earth Agents, just for you, man.
Okay. Hey, I'm actually going to be in Paris at the end of December, but I think if you're there, maybe I'll call you up and you can send some photos or something. If you got, hey, do you got one of those 360 degree apps on your?
Camera? I'm gonna have to get that now because I heard you talking about that in the beginning, and that sounds amazing.
Oh yeah, you know, I just discovered there's one app you can get on your phone. I don't know how much it is. It's for your regular phone, and then of course they have the 360 that most of the new smartphones have. But this new app allows you to expand the lens so that you can go up and down as well as in a circle. But my gut is that you got to buy a special camera, and those things are probably $1,000 or something. You know, maybe they're cheaper. Technology.
Well, have
a great
check
time
it out,
at Stonehenge. That should be great.
That's going to be cool. I'm going to check out Jimi Hendrix's apartment, of course, in London, and Abbey Road, and then boom, Stonehenge.
Excellent.
I'll be in touch, and thank you for having me on. And it was a great talk. And you know, the books will be available next week. And you know,
right? Cool.
There you
yeah, go to
Amazon,
and those of you who are listening, check out Ancient Giants of the Americas. It's a great book. Okay, man, we'll check back in with you. Maybe we'll have you do a report from England, and we'll have it during our later part of the month, or maybe record it and have it for December. We'll check in with you then, okay?
Sounds good, man. Thanks.
Okay, cheers. So
cheers.
That was Xavier And by the way, if you want to go to his Facebook page, it's, I'll spell it for you. It's X-A-V-I-A-N-T, Xavient Haze, H-A-Z-E. And he's got a pretty active Facebook page. And if you don't find it there, I will be posting photographs on the Facebook page and also on my website. So Ancient Aliens, Ancient Giants. I keep saying aliens. Ancient Giants of the Americas. That was cool. That was fun to hear. Okay, so that's it for today. As a reminder, next week we get into the academics. Dr. Susan Martinez has written a book on Lemuria. It's called The Island of Pan. And why this is an important interview is that this book actually documents the migration of these people from Lemuria into Mexico, which in many ways became the Maya. The Maya are a group of different cultures. And then eventually they migrated up, and we had Clifford Mahoti, the native Zuni elder, tell us that when he was on, that it's their history of this migration. And here now, Dr. Martinez is going to show us in this book, and I just got a copy of the book. It's huge, of this migration from this island of Pan. So that's next week's show. And I hope you'll join us. Remember, we're sponsored by Gaia, and Gaia has a special Earth Ancients page. It's Gaia, it's GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. Get a hold of that 99-cent special. First month's 99 cents. They have a ton of researchers. Many of the people we have on this show are featured on Gaia. They're our sponsors, and when you sponsor them, it helps me, helps us keep it going. All right, have a great day.